Okay. This is the review session on Thursday. Just in case you needed orientation. Actually, when I worked in a state mental hospital in Boston, when I was in college volunteering, one of the approaches that we used with these long-term patients, chronic schizophrenics, people who had been in the hospital a long time, was called reality therapy, and it consisted for us as undergraduates a lot of sort of reminding people what year it was and what month it was and what day it was and what day of the week it was, and that it was morning, and where they were, and trying to stimulate some interest in being oriented in reality. It didn't work very well, but at least it gave us something to do rather than sit there and be entertained by people's hallucinations. So, anyway, I put the exercises that we tackled yesterday and some more for today up there, but before we do that, I want to see if there are questions about the exam itself. Yes? It's a big range. It's always a big range. There will be people that you should not pay any attention to who will walk out after about 30 minutes. And you can just assume that they have, you know, forgotten they had a plane to catch or something and they're not finishing the exam. Or they know it all and they're fast and they'll get A's. And, you know, don't worry about them. Don't pay any attention to the people who leave early. And it will probably average, this is a wild guess, but my guess is that half of you will be finished in an hour and 22 minutes. So we'll check that out. An hour and 22 minutes. And then some of you, let's see, we start at 11:45. The next exam would be coming in here at 3:30? Anyway, we'll need to end by then. And there'll be people who will take a long time. That's fine. We don't have anything else planned for the afternoon. At least I don't. I thought Talia was coming. She was making up exam questions, so she's probably having so much fun that she has lost track of time. So that's what she was going to be doing anyway.
Can I ask for in the notes that you had, we didn't cover all the stages, but are we going to be tested on all the stages or just primarily?
For Galinsky, the six stages, yeah, you should know all six. We actually talked a little bit about each one, I think. But, you know, focus on the ones that interest you most. So, yeah, everything, whether we talked about it or not, everything in the reading is fair game. You know, obviously, I talk about the things that are most fun for me or most important for you. But the others, a lot of it is sort of backup, it's examples, it's information that's important to have in mind as you think about how you use Bronfenbrenner or any other interpretive system to understand families and family transitions. So anything is, you know, potential. Yes? In Galinsky, the stage of the transitions from one to the next. How are you understanding that? You have six stages. Okay. Yeah. So the transitions are brought on by the child. As the child goes through normal development, it presents new potentials, new possibilities, new abilities, and the parents have to adapt to those and cope with those. And for many of us, as the particularly the first child that we raise, as each one as it goes into each stage, we've never tried to parent somebody in that stage before, so the characteristics of the child as it comes into that next stage present us with a series of challenges and tasks and sometimes problems to solve, or things to discover about ourselves. And that's what Galinsky is trying to describe, what it is that the parents are encountering because of the changes that are taking place for the child. Good. The question is, do you have to know the authors of all of the readings? No, probably not. Not in the sense that I wouldn't ask a question like, so what did Hodder say? And expect you to remember that. Most of us, as I said in the session yesterday, most of us need both the name and the concept or something that we associate, because we don't learn things just by the name. And I wouldn't ask. So I'll give you enough information so that I'm asking about a concept and an author at the same time. So if you don't remember one, you may remember the other. Or it may be unnecessary to remember the name because we're talking about the concept. So, as I said yesterday, let me just repeat that for those of you. How many of you were here yesterday? Okay, so it's important to repeat it. I don't intentionally ask trick questions, and I try not to be picky. All of the questions will have something to do with developology and family. Some of them will be more about family from the readings or lectures. If I write I try to make my questions have enough information so that you're not trying to scan all of your intellectual space trying to remember what that one word referred to. So I'll give you enough information in the multiple choice questions. Give you enough information so that you should know what ballpark we're in. If you've done the reading, if you've been to class, it should be familiar. If you didn't have another exam at 8 tomorrow that wiped everything out or erased your disk. If I ask a picky question, it's Talia's fault because she's supposed to catch me on those. And if I ask what turns out to be a trick question, it wasn't a trick question when I wrote it. It became a trick question when you read it. And what happens is that sometimes new questions make all the sense in the world to me, and Talia would read them, and they would, because we know exactly what we're asking. And then the student reads it, and you discover that, oh, there are two ways you can read that question, or three. And it's just a badly written question. So sometimes I do that, but it's never intentional. And we end up, sometimes questions don't really have right answers, or we end up counting two answers as right. We try not to do that. It's a matter of staying awake and alert as we finish up the exam. There are 50 multiple choice. That number is dictated by the fact that there are 50 on each side of the Scantron. And when we grade them, the machine records each side separately. So if we have 51, we have to add. And I finally gave in and told Talia I would not put her through that extra little piece of mechanical work to add two scores up for the multiple choice. So there'll be 50 questions. Short answer and some short essay. And that's all there is. The short essay will be half page. I'll give you four questions, ask you to write. Do you like choices? Okay, so I'll give you four and ask you to write three, and you'll have half a page to write them, so practice writing small. They're usually fairly broad and ask you to pull in ideas and organize them. So the advice on that is to read the question carefully, make sure you understand what it's really asking. Think to yourself, if I were grading answers to this question, what would I look for? And the structure of the question, the actual question as it's asked, will give you sort of an outline for what the answer should contain. And then outline your answer. You know, have three or four points you want to make and then write it. But think about it, and then after you've written it, put it down, do something else, and then come back and read it again and revise it. Feel free to add to it, because sometimes when you think about something a bit later, you realize, oh, that would have been nice if I had said that. So go ahead and say that. That should be old stuff about writing essays. The short answer, will give you they're a bit like the eco exam, but not quite. They'll give you a situation and ask you to apply Bronfenbrenner to it in a couple of different ways. So they'll be fun. And the multiple choice cover everything, except nothing. There might be one question that is just about a definition. Everything else asks about interpretation or application. So they're not the simple kinds of questions like, a molar activity is. There may be examples and ask you what they're examples of and that sort of thing, but not the definition of molar activity is. You've already done that. You did that on the eco exam, so you know those inside and out. So if I only get 50 multiple choice questions, I won't waste any of them asking simple stuff. Any questions about the format or? Okay. Other questions?
Can you talk about the carrying Gottman article and the kind of the cascade of behavior and the trajectory of perception and wrong, obvious, or false?
Mm-hmm. Talk about it?
Yeah, just because when I was looking through my notes, I didn't really have much detail about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking through the article, I was confused.
Okay, the Carrere and Gottman article provides you the sort of background for Gottman's work on couple relationships and interactions that lead to his ability in his research to predict which couples are going to divorce. And what he's doing in the article, what they're doing in the article is outlining several of the kinds of studies that they've done and telling you what happens in relationships when people are interacting with each other that they can observe, and then if they keep track of what the couple is doing, and there are several different studies that they're summarizing their approach, what they're doing then is saying that what they see is what happens when people are having conflict with each other. They have disagreements and they're having difficulty sorting those out. And one of the patterns that they see is a pattern that goes from being flooded emotionally because of the disagreement that you're having and its content, your emotional reaction to that, and then how people respond to that leads them, they talk about it being kind of like a waterfall or a cascade going down the white water as you get lower and lower. And they describe the steps as people get into more and more difficulty in the conflict, in their discussion about the conflict. And then another part of the article, they're talking about what happens then when people are having conflict and difficulty. They go through another sort of whitewater cascade of steps of becoming lonely and unhappy and dissatisfied with the marriage. So there's another cascade that they describe. And they've observed these patterns. So if they look at a couple over time, they see them getting lower and lower if nothing intervenes to help them with their communication and their ways of dealing with each other emotionally. And then another part of the article, and I'm not going to capture all of them, but another part of it is the physiological responses that people have, what happens to your body as you're having a discussion about conflict issues. And the relationship of how intensely upset you get and whether you're then able to deal with the issue. And the more intensely upset you get, the more likely you are to become flooded and you stop listening to each other. And then the last part is, not the last part in the article, but the last part I want to mention is what data they use to predict divorce. And that boils down to the way people talk about each other and about their relationship. So if you're having people talk to you about their partners and about the relationship, if you just count the negative and positive things that they say and calculate the ratio, unhappy couples, the ones that you can predict will divorce, are saying negative things about each other. And happy couples say many more positive things about each other and about the relationship. And that's common sense, I think. People tend not to talk happily and positively about things they don't like. This is not rocket science, but they were the first rocket scientists who actually measured it, kept track of it, and used it to predict. And importantly, they looked at a lot of other things in the couple communication, things that other people have looked at and discovered that they could do best if they ignored all those other things and just looked at the communication and whether it was positive or negative. And that has, that's been the most robust finding about predicting divorce that anybody's come up with. It's been replicated a number of times. They've replicated it. And there are many studies trying to predict which couples will get happy and stay happy and which couples will get unhappy and divorce. And none of them have ever come up with anything that is more clearly predictive than what people say about each other when you ask them. There are lots of other correlates of divorce, but they don't predict very well. Age, age differential, educational differential, religious difference, those sorts of things, political attitudes, things like that. But if you want to know what the health of a couple is, talk to the couple and ask them to talk about each other and about the couplehood, about the relationship. And but it also helps us understand, and they just briefly mentioned this in the article, if I recall it correctly, that there are lots of attempts to try to improve marriages and couple relationships, and most of them don't work very well. Long term, they just don't work very well. It's funny, sad. Recently, I was talking to three people. I happened to run into them, and they were eating dinner. Three women, and they know each other because they were all in the same marriage encounter group, and they were all in that group because they were trying to strengthen their marriages, and they're all three divorced. So the marriage encounter, and they were talking about the other people in the group. And these were people who met every 2 weeks or every month for years, and did exercise, husbands and wives together, and they did exercises and worked on their communication, all kinds of things. And they said that half of the group or more is divorced now. That's not a very good outcome figure. What Gottman has done with his data is say, well, golly, you know, maybe if we just teach people how to talk nice when they're talking about their relationship, if we get them to focus on what they appreciate and teach them vocabulary for that, and if we teach them what to do when they're upset and how to talk when they're upset, then maybe we can have better success. And he's only semi-retired. He and his students are and colleagues are working on that. They have developed a program to teach people to stay married. And it just focuses on those very few items that are really predictive. Now, you can anticipate that when they're talking about each other and talking about good things, maybe they are learning to appreciate each other and changing their expectations. But the data aren't in on that. He also has a program and a book about teaching children the things that children might need to know to be able to go into relationships with more emotional intelligence than most of us had when we did that. So it's a book for parents and teachers about how to teach us to do relationships differently so maybe we will be able to stay married. Yeah, is that it? In a nutshell? Yeah. How would a role? The article is The Lust for the Long Haul, which I hope you all enjoyed. The study question focuses you on roles and activities and relations and what you do in your microsystem based on what she says about maintaining the romance and the sexuality, active sexuality in a relationship. Part of the role, and that's the specific question, is how would a role be involved in that? One is that partners often fall into roles that are not very sexy. And you define husband, wife, you define partner, you define middle-aged person or person I've been married to for 30 years. You define that in a way that is not conducive to maintaining a healthy sex life. So people expect in their role as parents and as people getting older that they're not supposed to have any fun. So one implication of that article, and there are a number of places where it comes up, is that you really have to think about yourself as a sexually interesting and interested person and behave accordingly. And it helps if both people do that. So if you're trying to keep your relationship alive and keep your spouse interested, it's helpful if you think about the spouse and yourself as lusty, sensual people who can still learn and have fun. And then you define your microsystem in a way that permits that to happen. And then you behave accordingly, which means you talk to each other as if you might be interested in having sex this week or month. You actually encourage it. So the molar activity becomes what some of us call perpetual foreplay. That life is foreplay. You get up in the morning and you start thinking about having sex later in the day, and you make sure that your partner knows about that, and shares that, so you make a date. You can do that, you know. You can also send the kids to grandma's. Kids, how would you like to spend a nice weekend at grandma's? She'll spoil you, and we're going to spend Saturday and most of Sunday in bed and enjoy each other. People do that, you know. And happy couples do that a lot. Because one of the things that several of the articles, I was thinking of Schwartz, particularly in happy couples, when you stop being interested in each other or responsive to each other, you can begin to wonder why you're together. And what typically happens is that one person stops being interested and the other person starts being interested someplace else because the partner is not responsive. And sometimes it's because you don't know how to initiate lust or sexual interest. Sometimes what you're doing isn't particularly interesting, which means that you have to talk. You have to talk about what you want, what you'd like to have in the relationship. So what she's describing in that article is lots of attitude changes and techniques to keep romance alive, and that's based on working with couples who have done that. Last Friday, one of the things you can do, I don't think I've mentioned it in this class, but one of the things that a university allows you is the opportunity to hear people from all over the world talk about things of all sorts, and you just have to look down through the list of lectures that are being given. And there's one in pediatrics every week, all year long, at 8 o'clock on Wednesday mornings in the medical school, in the medical education center. And they put out a list, and it's on my bulletin board. You can look down and see what they're covering. And somebody who's an expert on a particular topic will come and talk for an hour to update the pediatricians and pediatric nurses. But anybody can go. And what you discover is that, you know, sometimes it's Greek. You'd have no idea what they're talking about. Most of the time, you do know what they're talking about. And you can get an intuitive sense. And it's fun to listen to the local doctors ask questions. Friday mornings at 10:30 is psychiatry. And you can go and somebody will be talking about schizophrenia or treatment or drug abuse. Last Friday, it was called Toward Optimal Sexuality. And it was given by a woman from Ottawa who works with couples. She's a sexual therapist, sex therapist. And it was really fun because I had just reviewed the Lust article a couple of days before that, and here she is telling the psychiatrist basically what's in the article, except what she did. It's really just fascinating. She reviewed the literature and said, you know, what's out there in sex therapy is about dysfunction. It's really about erectile dysfunction. She said, when you look at most of the literature, not all of it, most of the literature for professionals, it's about helping people come to accept mediocrity. And that's her phrase. She said, they're not talking about great sex. The sex therapists are trying to just get people to be mediocre enough so that they can stay happily married or unhappily married. She says it began to interest her what great sex is. So she started a study, and she's been studying, she's been interviewing people who have been together for a long time. No young people said they never have great sex. They have athletic sex, but they don't have great sex. So she's been interviewing middle-aged people up to 80-something about great sex. And she has started to categorize it and to be able to describe how people have great sex. Because she said, look, if I'm going to be in a therapy situation where I have an unhappy couple, and they're not having sex at all, and definitely not having great sex, should I aim to teach them to have mediocre sex? Or can I learn something from people who have great sex? People in their 60s, 70s, and 80s who have great sex and can define that. So she said, I'm trying to learn from the experts how to help people have great sex. And it was fascinating for me because she was talking very much about that particular article. But I didn't ask her if she had read that. But I think the literature is out there. I just think that psychiatrists don't read it. You know, I don't know what they read, but they're not reading the stuff about good sexuality. But the good sexuality stuff is important in a family. If you're going to maintain a relationship as a couple for life, you can either decide to be bored and asexual, or you can decide to be happy and have a lot of pleasure in your life. But that doesn't happen unless you think about it. And what the article has done is suggest ways to do it. And what I wanted you to read the article, because I think it's an important concept, so that you can move from athletic sex to great sex. And there's a real difference. But think about it from a entrepreneurian point of view within the family. You have to organize it. You have to organize your microsystem so that you can have sex. You put three kids in a household, you can go for a long time without finding a way to do that, because kids will interfere. If you set your role as parent, and that's the most important thing, and you forget your role as wife, this is back to the question that you asked, if those two are incompatible and you focus on the parent role, you can stop having any romance in the relationship. Mom is not very exciting as a role, right? And the groans that happen in this class when I talk about your parents having sex in your bed and every place else now that you're gone, yeah, right, you can't, that's not part of the parent role. That's what we're talking about. You can't take that as part of the parent role. You can't imagine your father as a great lover. You can't think of your mother as a really sexy babe. And that's what happens. They become mom and they become dad to you, so they're asexual. That's okay. They become mom and dad to each other. And they stop being sexual. And you have to define your role differently and decide that you're, in fact, going to be the hot babe this guy married, and you're going to prove it to him every once in a while and expect him to reciprocate in the relationship. And when he starts to groan, you know, he's too tired, you tell him, okay, take a nap. Then I'm going to knock your socks off. Or, come on, big boy. Whatever it takes to remind you that the role of lover was the first one. And it's fundamentally the most important one, because you'll stop being active parents. And you will have each other, and you're more likely to have each other still around later if you've maintained the roles as lovers as a priority. You know, working in, I mean, not that you abandon your kids or throw them out or any of those things, but you stay interested in being lovers and keep that lust alive. In the lifespan course, which a few of you have taken, there's a piece in the lifespan book about the fact that people who live a long time happily married are sexually active and into their 70s, 80s, 90s. The only reason that people stop being sexually active is that they don't have partners. They don't have partners. So when you lose your spouse and you're 75, you're likely to stop being sexually active unless you can find somebody else. And the woman who was from Ottawa on Friday was talking about the fact that they did not know when they started the study how many singles there were out there looking and finding each other in their 70s. She even found what really surprised her was the number of people who we're having non-monogamous, openly non-monogamous, I can't even say it, let alone do it, non-monogamous sex in Ottawa, in that area. But she said it changed her whole attitude about old people. And said it's really, you know, she's, I don't know, probably 40, 45 herself. And she said it was just mind-blowing how many people there are out there who are still very sexually active, and it's a very important part of their lives. And some of them have said that menopause was the best thing that happened to their sex life. Others have said retirement. Boy, you ought to retire as soon as you can, because... Okay. And now, No, I will not teach the sexuality course. Gretchen does that very well. Thank you. Sure. The question is about non-monogamous sex and swinging, sharing partners. I personally am not interested. I mean, that wasn't your question, but I'm curious about it because for several reasons. One, I don't know where people get the time and energy to have more than one partner. But that's just me, you know, I don't know. I think I do not know couples who are comfortable enough in their couplehood and secure enough to allow that into their marriage, particularly on an equal and reciprocal basis. I know there are a lot of people who do, probably, and I don't know what the long-term literature on that is. It just has always seemed to me to be risky in many ways. And it's either... I was just thinking, I probably should just turn the question back to you rather than to you as a group, rather than go on at length about it. I think for some people, sex is just recreation, and I think you can probably do that. I think that's not great sex. But I was very surprised to hear the woman from Ottawa talking about people who do have open relationships in that sense, and do have group sex. There apparently is some group somewhere in the Ottawa area, people over 65 with group sex. I'm not interested. What I have seen, and some of the literature is pretty clear about that, is that it's usually one person in the couple who's interested and the other goes along, and then it falls apart and they don't stay involved very long. It's hard. Couples that I have been acquainted with in the past have typically ended up switching, one of them marrying one of the former partners. They can't maintain the communal approach to sex very well because it's hard to keep four people all at the same level. So it's never had much attraction for me. But that's not based on scientific evidence. I just think it's something that I wouldn't go into lightly in a relationship, and I'd be curious about why one would need that or want it. So, you know, if you happily go out and swing and it doesn't hurt your relationships, come back and tell me about it, and I'll change what I teach and use you as an example. We can think about that from a Brontë-Bernardian perspective, because when you look at the dyadic relationship and the multiple relationships that you would be in a swinging situation, if they were ongoing, then the question is whether, as we talked about in having an affair, is the other relationship, the extra relationship, going to be supportive of the marital relationship, and vice versa? Or is it going to be an interference with that? Are you going to be able to maintain each relationship with equality and reciprocity? Is there going to be equal power in those? Are you going to be able to maintain positive affect the way you would like it in a relationship that would continue to be fun? So you can ask those questions. I don't have answers for them, but that's where I would go in examining those relationships. There'll be very little on the exam about sex, by the way, other than things that are directly connected to the readings. Yeah. Galinsky.
Is that the image-making stage for you? Mm-hmm. Do you find that the images and
The question is about image making, and starting in the image making stage is the process of making images and the process of accepting or changing the images. Does that last through all the six stages? I can hear that two ways. Which way do you mean it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think Galinsky is very clear about the fact that the image is created and then constantly revised. And we have images of the newborn we're going to have, and we create those, but we also have images of the adolescent we're going to have, or what our kids going to be like when we launch them and they depart, what kind of parents they'll be. If we're thinking about our kids in that kind of depth, we have images. And she talks about the necessity to adjust the image that you have with the image, the reality that the child is really becoming. I mentioned that at one point, some of us have kids depart, and so there they are parenting, and we're watching them in their own marriages, and sometimes wondering, how did I have this kid? You know, this kid is not me. This kid is not like me. And most of us don't expect that a child would be very, very different from us. But many parents have that experience. It's very common, and Galinsky talks about instances of that where you send your kid out in the world and your child is doing things that you would never have done. Your child is parenting in ways that you would never have parented, doing things that you would never have done and wouldn't expect any child of you to do, and you wonder, where'd this kid come from? You know, where did it go wrong? And if you really don't like it, you can blame it on the other parent. Or you can, you know, maybe kid did too much acid, whatever it is. But that adjustment of images is something that continues all your life as your kids continue to grow. My internal chuckle is because there was a point, I don't know, probably 15 years ago, at a dinner table when I was visiting my mother, or she was visiting here before she moved here. At some point, she walked behind me, and she was looking at me, and she said, "My goodness, I didn't realize you were so gray." And her image of me, you know, what parent has an image of the child as a gray-haired old person? But I was becoming a gray-haired old person, and she wasn't ready for that to happen. It was just one of those many examples of she had an image, and she had to adjust it. Me getting white-haired. Yeah. Well, that's a constant theme through Galinsky, that the images are constantly revised. And if your kid is growing up as you expect, those images don't need much revision, and parenting may be fairly easy. But for some people, you know, those images just don't fit at all, the kid that you get. But the kid does things that you would not have anticipated, and you have to change it. And that's part of what keeps parents on edge. And sometimes a practical implication of that, particularly as kids get into adolescence, is that often in adolescence we do things that our parents do not anticipate. And they don't like them, and they're not happy about them. And their emotional reaction, if you want to be consistent with Galinsky, their emotional reaction to them is so strong because they didn't anticipate them. But we blindside our parents occasionally. They just had no idea that their kid would do something like that. And because they didn't have any idea, it's so novel that it takes a lot of work for them to incorporate what really happened, what their kid really did, into their view of the child and then of themselves. How could my kid do this? Where did we go wrong? And then figure out how you're going to deal with it. If parents are expecting something or anticipating it, we don't knock them off center so much, and their emotional reaction may not be so drastic. But sometimes, you know, parents have real drastic reactions to things because they didn't anticipate them. They're counting on you.
When they talk about setting limits and enforcing rules for the child, and you discuss like stress and not safe mm-hmm. stuff, what would you talk about as being the proper question or the proper way of setting limits?
The question is about setting limits and providing guidance and discipline for kids. And the Strauss article has a good chunk about that. Honig's article, also on raising responsible children, happy, well-adjusted children. Both of those articles talk about strategies. And developmentally, what's really important is that you look at your role as a parent, as creating a developmental dyad. And you're the more developed person in it. So what you're trying to do as a parent is help your child develop a valid and differentiated view of the world that he or she lives in. So that suggests that you need to be helping the kid understand the world, and that's what the interpretive stage is about. If you're going to enforce some rule, you ought to be able to explain why it's important and what happens if you violate it. So the kid has a sense of why there's a limit, if there's a limit, and why it's important. And it should be a limit that's appropriate for the child. So it means that the parent has to have a valid view of the kid. So you understand what kids can do. What that boils down to is defining an authoritative parent. And Galinsky talks about the styles of parenting. The authoritative parent is the one who helps the kid learn how the world works and makes sure that the settings that the child is in involve activities that the kid can do and that can become more complex and the kid can take more initiative in, which is giving power to the kid to make choices, to be responsible for him or herself in a way that fits within the expectations for roles of child in a particular setting. So the parent-child relationship becomes one of watching and helping the child become smarter and able to adapt to situations more effectively, by understanding what those situations are. Some parents throw their kids into situations to sink or swim and then criticize them for the fact they didn't swim instead of teaching them to swim. That's a metaphor. You shouldn't be expecting a kid to be able to do something if you haven't taught the child to do it, to be able to do it. So it needs to fit what the kid can do, and it also needs to be something that's within the kid's capacity, and you've made it a complex activity where it's a joint activity, teaching the child how to do what you want the child to do, and then gradually giving more responsibility for it to the child as is appropriate, and letting the child go with it. A question from Strauss is, where does spanking fit in that? And Strauss's argument is that there's no evidence that spanking is useful, that spanking is more effective than teaching a child what appropriate behavior is. And it has negative consequences, so don't do it. But that's predicated on the notion that you have alternative strategies. It doesn't mean you let the kid do whatever he or she wants, but you teach the child how to do the things that you're expecting. One of the pieces of advice that I give parents when their kids are coming up toward adolescence is to make sure that they're teaching before adolescence what the world that the kid is getting into includes and how to respond to it. So kid needs to be able to recognize risks and have practiced before you get into situations where there are risks, that you've practiced avoiding the risk. And you do that not at 16 or 17, but you do that when the kid is not there yet. You prepare the child for the settings that the child will be in and that are more likely to be in adolescence. And the other piece of advice is that thinking about the kid moving out into a wider world, my strategy is to keep the kid pretty close to home on a short leash, right, you're not renting the kid, short leash, with an early curfew and fairly strict limits about what you can do as the kid goes into adolescence, anticipating what might happen, because then you can give the kid the hope of lengthening that leash as the child becomes an adolescent and figures out how to be responsible. So the first 2 or 3 years of adolescence are testing. Okay. And you earn a later curfew when you demonstrate to me that you can get home for a later curfew because you can get home for this one. And when you're responsible about doing that and calling me, if you need to stay out later, you call me. And as the kid shows more and more responsibility, then you can lengthen that leash. And the result of that is that you have a kid who gradually becomes more and more responsible and able to take more and more responsible for him or herself safely. What I see many parents do and what the advice is based on is watching other people do it wrong, which is they don't put any limits on the kid. The kid gets into trouble and then they try to pull the leash back. And then you have a kid who's really surprised and very angry because you try to pull them in tight because they've made mistakes. And you can't get that freedom. You can't get that latitude back. Once the kid has been out there doing things and you try to pull them in tight and make their curfew earlier and make responsibility more important, you can't get it in a practical sense. You just can't do it. It's much easier if you just be tight before the kid really knows that that's what's happening and protect the child and then let the child earn the right to be self-governing, which is what we want the kid to be at 18. And those two go together, starting tight and letting it go so that when the kid gets to college, she knows how to behave and she knows how to deal with peer pressure. And she is self-governing rather than the option some parents give is let's keep the leash short, send them off to college and all hell breaks loose, as you've noticed. Some kids have never had any discipline. You don't want them next to you or in your room in the residence halls because they're not responsible. You don't want them around. And then we wish their parents had taught them something about how to live with other people. So you have Strauss, you have the Hanig article is full of wonderful advice. Alice is a wonderful old sweetheart. She must be 80. I don't know. Probably. She's a wonderful, everybody's grandmother. And the study question for that was to take each bit of her advice. This would be a fun exercise to do. Take each bit of her advice and see, can I translate that into ecosystem terms? What does it mean? Good. I'm just going to let her do it. Okay. That's fine. They're counting on you. Birth order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When going through it, how does, when there's only two kids in a family, like first born, second born, does the second born take on the role of the baby as well as the second born child?
Mm-hmm. The question is, in when there are two siblings, does the younger of the two take on the role of the baby or the role of second child? Her description of second child is based on becoming middle, I think, but you'd need to go back and read that carefully to see how she distinguishes that, how Renkel deals with that. My sense, and this is not in her article, my sense is that how the second born of two, how the younger of two deals with that position is in part dependent on the age span, the age difference between the two, and also the gender. Because I think if the two are close in age, and particularly if they're the same sex, the second born is more likely to be like a second child and not like a baby. If they're 4, 5, or 6 years apart, then the probability is that the younger is going to be more like a baby in her description. In both cases, what you're doing is kind of adjusting that description to get at what is the experience in the microsystem. What are the roles available? What are the relations available to each person under different circumstances? And that's the important piece about the birth order literature, that it's describing a different place in the microsystem and different opportunities and potentials for each person in a different position. What about blended families are just incredibly wonderful to watch, because what happens is in a blended family you're taking kids from two different microsystems and they've got their position. So you've got an older, and if you've got two or three kids, then you've got a middle, and you've got maybe a younger, maybe a baby, or maybe an only. And they've been in that position for some period of time. And then you have the divorce. Each of them responds to the divorce differently. Renkel didn't describe that. But they're likely to respond a little differently. And then you put them back together, and their position in the new sibling order, the blended sibling order, may be quite different. And you watch kids in that situation. You know, if you were the oldest in one group, you may still be the oldest in the blended group. But if you come in and now are second or third, and you were oldest, what you see is discombobulation. You don't know how to do that role. You've never had other kids telling you what to do and being more competent than you are. So you're suddenly demoted from the oldest to somewhere in the middle. And you can imagine then that when that happens, your role has changed. Microsystem has clearly changed. And that kid, you could hypothesize, the one who was oldest in one family and has now become second or third or fourth, is likely to have more competitiveness and potentially more anger with the stepsids who are older. Potentially. That's a hypothesis. It depends very much on how the stepsids feel about having younger siblings now. But you can set up a real conflict between those who've already been oldest and one who's just been demoted. And you can watch in some families jockeying for position, and resentment about having been reduced to not being the oldest anymore. There's another situation that's fun to watch, and that's older child adoption. I've seen a couple of families where you have a kid, and then you decide you'd like another kid, not a biological kid, so you head out to adopt. And I've seen two over the years where the only suddenly become the younger because you adopt a kid who's older than your biological child. And that's been fun in both of those situations. The older kid ended up being really good older brother. In both cases it was a male. And the younger, the ones who had been onlys, in one family it was a girl, in the other family it was a boy. And they both kind of adapted very nicely to having an older brother. And the older brother in each case, the adopted kid, had been an only and was really happy to have a younger sibling. And so after a little bit of adjustment to the adoption, the sibling relationships in both cases were really nice because it's okay. And there were only two siblings. And both of those have maintained good relationships into adulthood. But everybody was worried, in one case particularly, about how the only child would feel about being displaced from that position by somebody who was older. And it turned out to be good. Yeah, sure. I had those up. We might look at them. Oh. Oh, there we go. Okay. And I have to do this because the monitor's gone. We tackled the first three yesterday. And it's kind of fun. You're about to take off, right? Or your semester's ending anyway. You can look at that as an ecological transition. Some of you are going to change setting. But what happens? Can you describe what happens to you?
Mm-hmm.
So for people who are going back home, going back into a familiar microsystem.
Would it be like when you go back to that setting, like developmental for you because
uh-huh.
it's not new, you're not experiencing anything?
Yeah. So what happens when you go home? Somebody said yesterday, maybe the first time that you've spent any time. You went home for breaks, maybe. Christmas and maybe spring break. But what happens when you go back and actually live and work at home for the summer? Is that going to be developmentally facilitating? Why not? What happens when you go home? Sucked right back into the role as child. When did your parents last spend a lot of time with you when you weren't on vacation? Last year, right? So particularly for first-year students, your parents remember you as high school seniors. And so here you come. Speaking of curfews and short leashes, the parents just assume they don't know that you've changed. Yeah. Or they know you've changed and they didn't want you to, so they're going to put you right back into the role of high school senior. And that may be uncomfortable.
That can kind of go to Kalinsky's with what they imagine you to be as a student in college coming back.
Yeah.
It depends on how you've changed versus right. what they plan to change to.
Yeah.
And that can, depending on how your parents and their parenting
Great.
So they might give you the get go, but then they also might reel you back because they don't want to lift you up.
Yeah. So, and that's a nice application of Galinsky. It depends on what image they have created for you and what you've encouraged them. It's a transaction. What have you done this year to help them change their image? Do they see you as out of control, irresponsible, coming home with a carload of dirty laundry from last February? Do you need mommy and daddy? And that's their image. Or have you demonstrated that, hey, you can really keep it together and you got through exams fine and you've got plans for the summer and you've taken responsibility? That may have all helped them, may have helped them change that image. And they may be ready for you to come back with no curfew. So you can anticipate some jockeying about how you do this for the first week or two. But the roles have potentially changed, the dyad will have changed, but when you go back into the setting, and it's a standard picture in movies. You know, there are lots of books about the difficulty we have going home. And I think I mentioned that at some point earlier, that not today, but in the course, that it's nice to go home and have somebody cook and do laundry and treat you like their baby for a little while. But for some of us in our families, when we go back into the family, people pick up roles from 30 years before, and they're still a problem. They were a problem then, and they're still a problem. The people don't get out of them. The family system is sometimes very stable and very rigid. Some of you are going to be trying to maintain relationships. You suggested maintaining the long-distance dyad, inter-setting communication. So you've created a relationship this year. Now you're going to be separated. This is going to be interesting. How does it go? Does she communicate? Does he tell you about how much fun he's having with other people? What happens in that communication? How much does paranoia set in? Can I trust him? Can I trust her? At what point do you break up? How many late night emails and telephone calls are there? Or can you, and this might be an appropriate way to do it, say, okay, this is a college relationship, so we suspend it. Just put it in suspended animation until late August when we come back. Right. Maybe it's setting specific. Will your summer ecosystem be different? How many of you will be working this summer? How complex and exciting are your jobs? Compared to college? Nanny for the summer. Okay, so you get to be part of a completely different family. Now you can study them in a different way, right? Don't do it too obviously. Just keep your journal. But don't let them read it. And don't babble Bronfenbrenner at them. This will make them wonder if it's safe to have you around their children. You can babble it to the children. Teach them a new language. Okay, kids, we're going into a new setting. One of the questions yesterday was, who has the least interesting and complex molar activity to engage in repeatedly over the summer? Who has the worst job? Anybody want to volunteer theirs?
I work at a pizza place, and we have to do
You've worked there far too long, and you couldn't find another job for this summer. It's good money. The boss is a horror show, and his dyadic relationships are terrible. Ah, and he has a four-year-old daughter. Wait, this is going on the internet. We're not going to identify you. You know, somebody has a worse one. Hand straightening at Hannaford. Yeah. Now, you know what that reminds me of, Steve? It reminds me of the job of a department chairperson at the university. We say their job is straightening the ivy. Now, they don't have any real power. They just have to straighten the ivy on all the buildings.
Thank you.
Okay. See you tomorrow. Yes.
No, they close the door on you because they don't want to waste electricity.
I thought freezers by law had to have.
They have like a button, but if you use it, it sets off this alarm.
Oh, great! I want out. Okay. I'm just glad I don't have any of your jobs. I've been there, done that. What will happen when you return, when or if you return in the fall? Who wrote that? I did, I guess. Well, there are some seniors in the class. They won't be coming back. What happens in the fall? Ooh. New setting. New role. And you've already written the contract. You've discussed everything we talked about in class for cohabiting.
Okay.
You've already agreed that when things get rough, you're going to the counseling center together for couples therapy. You already do, all right. You're way ahead of the game. How does the ecosystem change when a grandparent moves into the household? We tackled that one yesterday, too. Okay. Grandparent moves in. Here comes grandma. Yep, the microsystem in that case is getting very turned up. Did one of this was a friend's household, did one of the friends have to vacate a room for grandma?
The youngest,
right. Yeah. Double up, kids. Grandma needs a private room. Or you can room with grandma if you want. Here's your choice, right? You can either share a room with grandma or you can share a room with your brother. And it's interesting that it was the youngest that got displaced. In some households, it's whoever has the nicest, biggest room gets displaced. And that... Uh-huh.
And grandma wanted the basement because it had the kitchen too.
Ah, okay. We call those mother-in-law apartments.
Yep. Yeah.
Which is nice because then she can be off by herself. Some settings permit privacy for members of the elder generation and some settings don't. And sometimes they're, you know, sharing a bathroom and nobody's happy. But if they have their own bath, they have kitchenette or something, and they can be away from the family, it usually works a lot better. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that goes back to what's happening to you when you go home next week or the week after. Your child remains, your parent remains his or her parent's child. And those parent-child relationships start playing out. And it's sometimes funny to watch if you're the grandchild. You watch your parent revert to being a petulant teenager. But the microsystem is also going to be changed because the marital dyad is likely to be suffering when a grandparent moves in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which also changes your role because then you want to kind of get put in the position to take care of someone.
Right. If the grandparent is moving in because of health problems and inability to take care of herself or himself, then you have caretaking roles and responsibilities for other people in the family. It can be a wonderful opportunity for kids. Years ago, I had a student who described in this class her grandmother moving in. Because she was very ill, she had chronic illness, and the student had taken over a primary caregiving role for her grandmother and continued that through high school until I think it was during senior year of high school the grandmother finally died, but the student was able to go through all of that. The grandmother died at home, and the student was with her when she died. And she described it as probably the highlight of her development in adolescence, that she had been finally in her family able to do something that was responsible. She developed a wonderful relationship with her grandmother. It gave her career direction, and she worked in a hospice. She worked with elders and she worked in a hospice. Not sure where she is now, but for several years she was a hospice caregiver. And she just described it as a beautiful situation because she was the one who was able to do that. And she said her adolescence would have been quite different had her grandmother not been there. And some people in the class were they're feeling sorry for her that she'd had this terrible experience, and she was seeing it as a very positive experience of learning about her grandmother, learning about her family, learning about herself, being able to contribute to the family in a really important way. Her grandmother was originally from another culture, and during the two and a half years, she taught the granddaughter her language, and they ended up speaking the language together. And the other children in the family, her siblings, didn't have that opportunity. They didn't learn it, so she became the one who was the connection to the country of origin and that community. So it was a really powerful experience. The other one we talked about yesterday briefly was what happens when I think I used the example of an 8-year-old develops a serious illness, and you're dealing with healthcare, you're dealing with hospitalization, what happens to the other siblings. I just realized we are at almost 5:30 and I do have to go, but essentially the point here is that you have this whole framework in your heads, and you can think about the whole ecosystem. You can think about the dyadic relationships, the roles, the activities, the setting, how it changes, the microsystem, the mesosystem connections for any kind of event that happens in life. Now, whether it's leaving college or the last one, transition from college. What are you going to do when you graduate? And how would you design that, thinking about leaving this setting permanently? We won't let you back in. Well, you can come to graduate school. But so you're going to go off and maybe get a job, probably. You think about the hypotheses about the mesosystem and activities, and think about how would you, while you're a student, begin a developmental trajectory. Some of you are clearly on one, but others may not be on a trajectory that's fairly clear. Nursing students know what they're going to do. Education students often know what they're going to do, and they know how to do that in their student teaching. But a lot of people don't. And so what do you do to find out about the settings that are out there and to find out how they operate? It's called internships. Getting into those settings, talking to people, creating the inner setting communication before you get there, thinking about the roles and what you can do while you're in college that would be like roles that you might have outside. So you can think about the ecosystem, you think about it descriptively. You know, what's going to happen to your ecosystem if you're a college student and your parent remarries while you're a college student? Okay. You can speculate about that using the framework that you now have. But then you can also think about changing. You've got hypotheses that suggest how you might change the ecosystem, or how you might explore it in ways that would let you be more familiar with it and be able to deal with it more effectively. Finding out what activities are going to be required and making sure you practice them before you get there. Or if you were advising a family with a child who develops a serious illness, or you knew somebody, how could you intervene that would be helpful? But when you look at their ecosystem and how it's changing, you know, they may have a 4-year-old who is afraid of the hospital, figures the 8-year-old is going to die if you go to the hospital, that's what happens. So who explains what's going on to the four-year-old? Who provides opportunity for the four-year-old to be in a normal situation? Who relieves the parents? Who offers to sit with the eight-year-old who's in the hospital while the parents go make love or go out for coffee or spend some time by themselves or take a nap or whatever it is they might need to do to maintain their sanity? If you think about the ecosystem as it's being changed by the event of the illness, then you can figure out where you might change it, where you might add something to it that would be helpful. If you're interested in the hospitalized child piece, that's called Child Life. And you can do a career in that. You can do an internship in that in human development and family studies. And get certified as a family life, as a child life specialist, and work in a hospital helping parents deal with those issues. I need to go. You need to go. Good night's sleep, good breakfast, snack before class so you're not too hungry, or lunch. I'm sorry. 11:45. Right here. Number two pencil. And I'll see you all tomorrow.